Well, may I again add my welcome to that of Alex. Welcome to a new term and a new series. So we will be spending the next five Sunday evenings studying the life of Israel's wealthiest and supposedly wisest king, Solomon, whose name means, does anybody know? Peaceful. And it is true that his reign, from its thought about 970 BC to 931 BC, was a time of peace and a time of prosperity for God's people Israel. Some see it as Israel's golden period. God's promises of land to Abraham's descendants seem to be almost complete, and his promise of David's throne being established seem to be coming true. Perhaps you remember Solomon for his wisdom, or for building God's temple, or for his splendor and his wealth. We'll be looking at these in coming weeks. But perhaps you remember Solomon for the tragedy of his downfall, his 700 wives and 300 concubines. How would you keep count? Leading to his departure from God's ways and the following of other gods. Was he really that wise? Well, as we put ourselves into the story, with thanks for Michelle for reading it, it's worth saying just a few things about the Book of Kings, which our Bibles have artificially split into 1 Kings and 2 Kings. The book was written, as the name implies, about the Israelite monarchy, which ended in the 6th century BC. We don't know who wrote Kings, maybe Jeremiah, maybe a group of Levites. What we do know from the language is that the authors most certainly had the book of Deuteronomy in one hand as they described Israel's history. And remember that Kings is a story. It is Old Testament narrative. And this means, first, that the authors assume that we too know God's law as found in Deuteronomy. And therefore, we can draw our own conclusions about the morality of the king's story and the horrific things that we read in Bible narratives. Sisters being raped, brothers being killed, thrones being seized. The Old Testament law, as found in Deuteronomy in this case, is our benchmark. The narrator very rarely in a Bible story intervenes and says, oh, this was good, or oh, this was bad, because actually that's our job, Deuteronomy in hand. So engage with the text as we read and draw your own conclusions. But Kings being narrative also means, second and relatedly, that there will be lots of grey areas in the story. Don't assume that we're supposed to follow Solomon's example in everything. Narratives are not supposed to be moral character studies, but they are the story of God, and they're the story of what God is doing with his people Israel. Human politics, biblical or modern, has always, hasn't it, had a sliding scale of grey, shades of grey, unlike the Old Testament law, which deals with black and white. So there, bear that in mind in this series. Draw your own conclusions through the grey areas. Now, you may realize that the start of Solomon's story is also the end of David's story. If you recall, David had been promised back in 2 Samuel chapter 7 that God would raise up one of his own sons and would establish his kingdom, David's kingdom, forever. But in light of God's judgment on David, if you remember, for his misdemeanors with Bathsheba, and in light of the awful backstabbing and attempted coups that follow in the rest of 2 Samuel. How will God's promise to establish David's throne happen? That is the question that 1 Kings 1 to 2 is trying to answer. So let's start with chapter 1, which we can call the successor of the throne. This phrase of God's, sit on my throne, being repeated 9 times in chapter 1. It's about the successor. The question is, who's going to sit on, remember this is actually God's throne. That is, who's going to be David's successor? Who's going to be the continuer of the Davidic covenant? In the first 3 verses, we read that David's glory days are gone. He's old and he's cold and he needs a concubine, or it could be another wife, Abishag, to keep him warm. Perhaps we find that a bit strange. Meanwhile, Adonijah thinks the fact that he is David's oldest living son gives him the right to be the next king. I mean, to be fair, oldest son was the policy of most other ancient Near Eastern nations. But Adonijah doesn't wait to be asked. So verse 5, he puts himself forward. Literally, he lifted himself up. That's what it says. And that tells you a lot. He says, I want to be king. I will be king. But Adonijah forgets that it was God that chose Saul. It was God that chose his father David. And Adonijah's lust for power makes him forget whose decision this is. God's, through the mouthpiece of David. Never mind that Adonijah was handsome, verse 6, as kings are supposed to be. Handsome means good looking, but it also means popular, liked, admired. But it doesn't necessarily mean chosen by God. Nevertheless, he creates, verse 6, a special guard with chariots and horses and 50 men, and he draws to himself Joab, that's the general of David's army, for a strong military backing. And he draws to himself Abiathar, the priest, for a self-made religious backing. But certain key people, verse 8, do not join Adonijah. Most notably, Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet. And then Adonijah makes sacrifices at the stone of Zochelet, announcing his kingship. Not the traditional place for crowning a king. And he has a very selective guest list. Nathan the prophet and Solomon, notably, not invited. A self-declared king. How did God's people get into such a sorry state? Remember, we read this with the Old Testament law in our hands, noting where the whole nation has got it wrong. But dying David, as leader of the nation, albeit only just, has to take some responsibility for not checking Adonijah's improper ambition. Verse 6, his father had never interfered with him by asking, why do you behave as you do? There we go. So David himself is partly to blame. It is true that David had been negligent. He'd been passive. In 2 Samuel, his throne had nearly been robbed by his then eldest son, Absalom, who you may know came to a very gruesome end. Is history repeating itself? David had never said the next king would be Adonijah, but it seems that's because he'd never really said anything to Adonijah much at all. He didn't discipline him. Often dysfunctional families can show their worst side at big family gatherings, big events, weddings and funerals and the like. And of course, a few funerals are in the offing here. Power games. A family at war. That's exactly what's happening. A bit of a digression. If you Google succession to the British throne, of course, it's clear that Charles, Prince of Wales, is next in line. But because the official succession is based on the now amended Act of Settlement from 1701, you qualify by being a descendant of Sophia, Electress of Hanover, whilst being in communion with the Church of England. Which means, according to one estimate, that the line of succession is not just those that you see on the screen, but that there are actually 4,973 people in succession to the British throne. Mainly obscure Europeans such as number 77 in line, Her Royal Highness Princess Ingrid Alexandra of Norway, age 12. The point is, succession to the British throne is based on descent and parliamentary statute. There's a clear list showing who's next in line. No room for power games, no room for coups. Contrast that with the old Turkish Ottoman Empire. Ruled from Istanbul, the Sultan would give his sons different provinces to govern, and upon the Sultan's death, sons would race back to Istanbul to seize the throne. It really was a race to the top, upon which the fastest brother would execute or exile the others, seizing power. So you could work out the Sultan's favourite son, the one who had been asked to govern closest to home. But even that wasn't a guarantee. Now, what we have in 1 Kings is more like the Turkish Ottoman Empire than the British royal family. And it ends up like a big game of chess, because chess is essentially court politics. Will Adonijah seize power? What's going to happen? Well, it's Nathan the prophet who comes to save the day again. Remember, it was this Nathan who had to tell David after he slept with Bathsheba, "You are that man." And there was punishment from God as the resulting child died. And then there was repentance from David. And Bathsheba eventually gave birth to a second son, Solomon, also called Jedediah. But that was always a bit of an awkward family relationship for David. So Nathan prompts Bathsheba, and one after the other, they conveniently both tell David of Adonijah's attempted coup. And Bathsheba reminds David of his previous oath to make Solomon, who happens to be her son, king, which is actually not recorded in 2 Samuel. So when David realizes what's happening, it makes him look a bit easily led here, doesn't it? When he realizes what's happening, he says, chapter 1, verse 32, "Oh, call in Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. When they came before the king, he said to them, 'Take your Lord's servants with you and set Solomon, my son, on my own mule and take him down to Gihon. There shall Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him king over Israel. Blow the trumpet and shout, "Long live King Solomon!" Then you are to go up with him, and he is to come and sit on my throne and reign in my place. I have appointed him ruler over Israel and Judah." And if you read on, that's exactly what happens from verses 38 to 40. But it was a bit of a back room job. "Quick, sit on this mule, here's the crown, here's some oil, blow the trumpet, long live King Solomon." To think that this is the text that inspired Handel to write Zadok the priest, his majestic coronation anthem, which has been used at every British coronation since the Hanovers. To compare the rushed affair of Solomon's coronation with our present Queen's coronation in 1953, perhaps the most... 1953, yes. Perhaps the most famous ever occasion when Zadok the priest had been played. Solomon's coronation was not as grand as Handel's anthem would maybe have us think. But then Adonijah hears what's happened. His stooges disperse, and he ends up bowing down to Solomon, begging for his life in verse 53. But a bow before a king does not a loyal subject make. Let me just pause at this point and say, by way of application, if we're supposed to read this with Deuteronomy in hand, we're meant to conclude that putting ourselves forward rather than humbly accepting God's choice is not God's plan for us. It's highly likely that Adonijah knew of David's and therefore God's choice of Solomon as king before he declared himself king. How can you argue with God? It's futile. Who knows, maybe there are situations in your life where we're tempted to argue against God's clear and obvious plan as revealed in Scripture. Don't. Let God work things out. Leave things to his time. Let God's will come to pass. So that was chapter 1. More briefly, on to chapter 2, where this phrase, firmly established in Solomon's hands, is repeated 4 times. So if you want a heading, chapter 2 is about the security of the throne. And you have to say, this is where it gets pretty grey. On one hand, it is absolutely God's will to crown Solomon as the one who establishes David's throne, the continuer of the Davidic covenant. On the other hand, is it God's will to remove all of Solomon's enemies in the way that Solomon does in the part of chapter 2 that we didn't read? Or is that just Solomon's will? I'll leave that for you to decide. But again, with Deuteronomy in hand, consider what God does say to Solomon through his dying father David. He says, as king, live in obedience to God. Live by the Mosaic covenant so that you will fulfill the Davidic covenant. Have a look with me at verse 1 of chapter 2 again. When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. I'm about to go the way of all the earth, he said, so be strong, show yourself a man, and observe what the Lord your God requires. Here it is. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and requirements, as written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go, and that the Lord may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. Well, what great advice that is at the start of your reign. I don't think that you'd find Machiavelli advising the prince in this way. I don't think these things were said to Theresa May at the beginning of her prime ministership. But God, through David, says to Solomon, do not be an autocrat, do not be a dictator, but be a true man. Put God first in everything. I'm sure David would have looked back on his life and was aware how awfully he hadn't done all that he was telling his son Solomon to do. But as we read, even in the rest of this chapter, does Solomon do this? Would all the kings after him do this? Of course, no one said that the kings of Israel were perfect. The book of Kings is essentially a report on how each king of Israel and then Judah fared in living up to this charge of chapter 2, verse 1 to 4. You may remember that phrase that sadly comes up again and again and again in Kings. This king did evil in the eyes of the Lord. That is shorthand for they were not loyal to God as set out here. And whilst it's true that in God's economy, it won't do to have a man's plans come up against God's established king, personally, I take the line that the writer is presenting it as Solomon, prompted by David's bloodthirsty pleas a bit later on, and not God, who decides to execute and banish all his enemies in the rest of the chapter, in all its grim detail. David's very last words to Solomon are indeed just an appeal for revenge. So while some loyal servants are protected, like Barzillai of Gilead, verse 7, most of David's opposition are done away with by Solomon using his loyal but lethal henchman Benaiah. So we have Adonijah, after asking for Abishag, the former king's wife or concubine, to gain legitimacy, he ends up losing his life. Meanwhile, Abiathar is removed from the priesthood. Joab and Shimei, for different reasons, also end up dead. David's throne, established through Solomon? Yes, but only through a lot of grey. Only through a lot of bloodshed, not the ideal way. But that is because Solomon is not the ideal king. And this is where we're heading this evening. Solomon is but a pale reflection of God's true king. Yes, Solomon is the first physical manifestation of the Davidic covenant coming to pass. But a close examination of 2 Samuel 7 should make it clear that he is not its ultimate fulfillment. We have to wait another 950 years for God's throne to ultimately and finally be established. When King Jesus, the one we've just sung about, and to also from the line of the Judaic monarchy, as Matthew's gospel shows us, broke into history to establish God's true king and God's true kingdom. King Jesus, who, unlike Solomon, was never morally compromised by decisions he must make. King Jesus is the only one who truly carried out chapter 2, verse 1 to 4. He came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it, he said in the Sermon on the Mount. And King Jesus comes to demand absolute loyalty from us, his subjects. And so even if 1 Kings 2 prompts us to ask whether subjects of Israel were loyal to God's King Solomon, we are prompted here to think of an even greater question. Are we faithful and loyal to King Jesus, who was truly wise, truly faithful, and truly king, who was and is the greatest king? You see, no one can turn to King Jesus and say, "Oh, that's not fair." If we do have anything to say to him, it's, "You are right in your judgments, O King." Unlike Solomon and unlike political leaders the world over today, even as they meet in Hangzhou for the G20 meeting, King Jesus doesn't harbor grievances and instigate coups Rather, he offers a fresh start to all who make allegiance to him. So as we come to the table, and as we think of King Jesus, I want to ask, as I ask most weeks standing here, are you faithful to the faithful King? Are you true to the true King? Is your allegiance totally and completely given to the King of Kings, the forever King who made you to serve him and love him and enjoy him forever? Perhaps we can spend just a moment in quiet, but that is to be a moment of worship, a moment of adoration, a moment of thanking and glorifying King Jesus. Thank you, King Jesus, that you are the perfect King, the flawless King, the King who rules supremely, the King of Kings. Help us to treat you as such in our lives. Help us to worship you in the way that we live, in speaking of you, in declaring your kingdom, both now and your kingdom come. Help us as we meditate on you, the King who gave your life for his people. What sort of King does that? Only you, King Jesus, sovereign over all, given for all who trust in you. Amen.